we have a very big visual toolbox, but it really comes down to really good content and how you show that content. So the project I'm working on now, I've moved from newspapers to books and multimedia projects, deals with wildfire, and some of you have probably seen this photo a number of times. This was my first photo of wildfire. This is a prison firefighter in Connecticut many years ago. And as part of that project, I spent a lot of time last year and this year covering various fires. So, and I find I fall back into the same basic types of images. We have, you know, storytelling overalls. We have expressions. And we have really excellent details. And I find I shoot a lot more details now that I'm working a lot in video and audio slideshows and things like that. And we also have seen things change quite a bit. So this is a guy with the cell phone photo of the fire that destroyed his house a couple days after it did that. And yeah, so that was one way in which I kind of saw how much we're changing in visual storytelling. And another way was a couple of years ago when a photographer from National Public Radio won a lot of the top honors in the Pictures of the Year competition. And that took a few minutes for me to wrap my head around that one of the best places to go to for photojournalism was National Public Radio. But there are a lot of really amazing options with all of this, and I'm gonna leave this for just a second, and I just want to show a couple more photos from Texas since we're here. Let's see if I've got this here where I want it. I may not. That are of the drought from last year. But maybe I've accidentally closed that. Let's see. Yeah, is there, this is it. This wasn't the way I actually wanted to show it. Here we go. This is a pretty good way to show it. So you've probably seen this picture in our program. But Jay Yonner did just a fabulous job last year for the Austin American Statesman documenting this drought. And having been down here covering the fires myself, I thought that this was really fabulous work covering an environmental story. These are pretty different from what I did a long time ago in newspapers. There aren't nearly as many people in these photographs as we used to have. A lot of these are showing, you know, both details and overalls, but remnants and the effects of things that have happened, but not necessarily as many people photographs. And when you do have the people photographs, though, they're really dramatic and really great moments. So this is a farmer in Garfield, Texas, with his cotton. So I just wanted to show a few of those, the idea of being able to show audio slideshows of photos online, we can show a lot more images now. So that's changed a lot of the way that we think when we're shooting. You know, it used to be when I was in newspapers that you went out and you would work, you know, the good part of a day to make one really good picture that could be used really well in the newspaper. And you may have, you know, thousands of also-rans or other really great pictures that just didn't have the space. And now we can put all those pictures up online, and it becomes a method, you know, an idea of choosing the order and how do photos play off of each other. It's a lot more like thinking in terms of video. The other thing that we've seen photographers move into is video. And so this is another thing that I show my students in photojournalism. These are, you know, the two most memorable photos of the Vietnam War. There is television footage of both of these incidents. And so I always like to ask my students, why is it that we remember the still photographs and not the television footage? And it's not that video or television footage isn't as storytelling as still photography, and it's not that still photography is better than writing or anything like that. It's a matter of recognizing the story and the tool that's going to work best. Still photographs really are about capturing these decisive moments. And a video doesn't really require a decisive moment. It's nice if it has it, and you'll see some really beautiful and well-done video, but it's fleeting. And so you're not going to sit there and look at this particular image, this captured moment of history. and, you know, kind of parse it. You're basically saying that this is, you know, this such a significant second of history that you should stop it and look at it for a while. Whereas video, we're actually watching things flow, and video, you know, putting together good video is actually about making things flow together and having time flow in a really effective way. And I just before I pass things on, I want to show one little bit of video here that is you know, I'm actually what I'll do is I think I will, well, no, I'll show it now. I'll show just a little bit of it. And I'm not sure if you all are, this is from a project called Powering the Nation done by the University of North Carolina. And this is from a big project called Coal, A Love Story. This is a video about the coal.
West Virginia, I'm proud to be a true coal miner's daughter. I am contestant number 14, Ariana Brynn Bailey.
I'm just not a dumb pageant girl. I want to finish college. That's the first thing I want to do. I want to get out and go and see other places.
I know she wants to leave. I know she wants to experience the world, but sometimes the world can be a very harsh place. She was born straight into coal, straight into it. With the coal queen, she is representing not only her father, but every other miner that leaves the house every morning to make an honest living.
My dad was a coal miner. My grandfather was a coal miner. It's just a way of life.
Coal is the most important thing in our household. My daddy's been proud of me for a lot of things, but if I won this pageant, he would be extra proud. I know that they don't want me leaving, but I think it's just because they don't want to let go of their little girl.
Didn't have time. I gotta go.
It's the worst nightmare in the world to think that something could happen to the man you love.
I've been in the mines for 34 years. In the last year I worked there, I was scared.
So I'm gonna cut this here and just make a couple of points. So you know, as we've moved, you know, we've had all kinds of still photographers that have moved into video. And so we've kind of ended up in a new world of video storytelling. There's a lot about that video that is typical of a lot of videos, where if you were to actually freeze time and take that frame out, it's not a particularly great still photo. But there's a lot in that video where it is really composed. It's very cinematic. It's, you know, incredibly storytelling, you know, imagery and footage. Another thing that I really like about that is that student work. So, you know, this is somebody who's just been at that for a little while. And, so we all have our point and shoot cameras. You know, I've got this tiny little thing. I can barely pick it up. And they basically all shoot video now. And occasionally, you know, even with your cell phone, you know, you're going to make some video. And if it happens to be, you know, like the bus explosion in London, they may be newsworthy and they may get aired. But the reality is it's pretty rare that you're going to make this kind of video with this little camera. So just, you know, as a case in point, you know, we have this idea that the tools have gotten much simpler and smaller and easy to use. And I just brought my little rig when I shoot video now. So I look pretty silly. And this idea that you can be a fly on the wall in some of these things where, you know, you have this stabilization thing. You know, when you're shooting video, the first thing you're going to learn with video is that audio is the most important part of video. You know, people will watch bad video for a long time if it's got great audio. But they will turn away from bad audio really quickly, no matter how big the pictures are. So a lot of us have learned that the hard way. So you have, you know, your external recorder. You have this, you know, special microphone for it. You have to have a rig to stabilize the whole thing. I actually have a big viewfinder system that goes on the back of this. So things have, in some ways, gotten simpler in the way we can tell stories, but the gear and things have gotten fairly complex. I think my friend Jan Morten, who I was working with yesterday, he's here from Norway shooting some videos at our conference, and he has quite a rig that he's carrying around to these oil wells and frack sites. And with that, I think I'm going to move us on to illustrations to Emily. Let me take a second to bring up her PowerPoint or her program right here. Is this the one where we're missing ones? There you go. Yeah, why don't we just trade places?
No, you can still go. Sure. Yeah. Okay. So, photographs are real great for a lot of things. Oh, can you hear me? Real close. Okay. So, photographs are good for a lot of things, but sometimes illustrations are the tool to use, depending on the case, and we're going to talk about some of those cases. So I was asked to introduce a little bit about myself and the illustration that I'm doing right now. My current project is Walkabout M, and it started when I was traveling in Zambia. And so I started with a tiny little sketchbook, and I've got them up here so you guys can thumb through them. But I was just drawing these little tiny pictures like this big for myself when I was on vacation. And I was traveling with a group of wildlife biologists, and at this point I'm on the Zambezi River between Zambia and Zimbabwe. And somewhere in the background there, I was drawing hippos. And at one point, I found these little bugs. This one, I was carrying an enormous, like, jug of water up from a river, and this guy clung onto my clothing. And so I was like, oh my god, it's so cute, I have to draw it. And then I started drawing, and it's just really, really loose doodles. These are not fine science illustrations like I was trained to do many years ago. But the kids liked it. And so the kids in the village went from smushing bugs to collecting them and then drawing them with me within, like, 3 days. It was amazing to watch. And so they kept getting passed around at these different dinner parties, and people said, oh, you should share the drawings, you should share the drawings. It's just my sketchbook. But it's sort of evolving into something else. So my background's in science communication. And so I took this same technique to a lab, and this is a little while ago, this was to talk about adaptive optics. So who here knows what adaptive optics is? Okay, so a couple people, but not very many. And this is sort of the fun tool of it, is that we do something that looks like comics, okay? And I can draw about a panel a day. And I'm working with a researcher who does university adaptive optics research. And over about a 2-week period, we talked about what adaptive optics was and what's new about the technology and how they're using it, both in space science and in molecular biology. And this is really fun because it's a curated form of science communication. So the researcher is there with me. Instead of doing a traditional interview text format, we get to talk about the research. Again, so here's some concept-y illustration. And this is, you know, we're actually looking at some of the details. You know, Michael was talking about details and storytelling. So this is one of the actual chips, and we've got a diamond there for perspective. But we're drawing basically that it's a little block, and it doesn't really look like very much. And we can show what we can get with the little block, and why some of this is useful. And I'm going to go through this pretty quickly. But it was interesting because it's a moderated format, so the researcher's still there with me. And then what's cool about the new media, and I want to put this up because this is a blog, is that this is happening real time. So the researcher gets to answer the public's questions. So when they have questions about the comment or the content, he gets to write replies, and we get to link it up to videos, and we get to link it to actual research articles, so that people who are just interested in the comics can just look at the comics, and people who want to look deeper can really look deeper into the actual research and ask questions. So it's a multi-level kind of content, and this is kind of new, and I've been experimenting with it for about a year and a half now. And so the science is fun, but what I find really like is charismatic macrofauna. So we've got some bats in Australia, and we've got some establishing shots, so national parks. And then we've got some again, you know, we're talking about storytelling, so here's some spiny things we found. And this starts to get to a place where we can talk about some of the ecosystems in remote places. This is another example. Kakadu National Park is in the middle of nowhere, Darwin. It's really, really hot. The paint does not dry in the tropics. This whole page was drawn on a walk. Each of those drawings, I think I had like 3 minutes or less as I'm on a hike with a wildlife biologist. So these are happening really, really fast, and I get to post them from the field. So everything is uploaded through a smartphone. So that's really kind of exciting because it means things can happen remotely, real time, and be illustrated. And people like drawings. I don't know why, but they really, really like cute little pictures of ants and bugs. And they really like it when you draw your dinner. I've done a lot of drawings of food. One day I just baked cookies and then drew them. But I got so many replies to this. It was really, really a lot of fun. And because it's fun, I think we get to talk about some more interesting environmental and medical and science issues, and we get to engage a public in a way that not everybody who's willing to read a big block of text is going to do. It's really a hook to pull people into the content. So now we're going to talk about other kinds of illustrations. So there's a lot of different kinds, and one of the biggest things that we're doing is showing things that cameras can't show. And some of these are things that you just literally can't take a picture of. They're too big or too small, or they're of a concept. So some examples are space. NASA's got a ton of images, but some of the best conceptual illustrations we have of like a whole solar system or, you know, all the planets in perspective, those have to be illustrated at least on some level, even if we're working from NASA reference material. And NASA does have a fair number of illustrators working for them. Molecular images. So this is protein synthesis. So we've got inside near the nucleus, I don't have a pointer. In the nucleus, we've got transcription and translation, and then eventually protein synthesis, the pink blob sort of closest to Michael's head. Paleontology is another great example. So things that have happened in the past, or maybe you're writing about technology that's not fully developed yet and you're trying to hypothesize about what it might look like. We have a lot of fossils, but we don't actually know what any of those creatures looked like. And so when we're putting together, diagrams or images for the public, they really want illustration because it's one thing to look at a skeleton, but it's another to imagine what that creature might have looked like. And there is a certain amount of guesswork involved, but I'll show a little bit later. There are some examples that I have of how those fossils translate into how we get those images. So another thing that a camera can't take a picture of is fake things. So here's a conservation poster talking about native bees, but you can't actually take all of the bees and dump them in a pile and take a picture. It wouldn't be a very pretty picture. I mean, pile of dead bees, right? So here the illustrator, this is Steve Buchanan, he's recreated sort of a living behavior of them sort of gathering around their host flowers. And it's a really pretty poster. Much prettier than a pile of dead bees, which is probably what you could photograph. We talk about behaviors. So again, video and cartoons are going to be real good ways to talk about behaviors. But this one's got a lot of motion to it, and it's a still image, and this was developed for Mono Lake. And this gull fly behavior is really distinctive of that region. And The illustrator who did this, I know it's gotten all of a like tourist merchandise. You know, people putting on T-shirts and stuff. So here we're talking about fossils again. But we're talking about fossils for a different reason. So these fossils were eventually turned into a reconstruction of what a baby Triceratops looked like. But it was really important to the researcher to not only include the photographs, but to do these carbon dust illustrations. And these are showing very specific pitting and grooving, which is where nerves would have connected. So we're learning more about this than just what the fossil looked like. It helps people who know enough about anatomy to be able to connect where muscle and tissue would have connected to give us a more accurate representation of what that creature probably looked like. And that's really important for the paleontologists. So that's clarifying information. Again, this isn't something that just photography does. They're usually used together. So storytelling is sort of the purpose of this talk. I pulled up this example because it was published this year. Rachel Allison, she did a graphic novel of the story of a plastic bag that gets into the big pile of trash offshore. And again, this is a story of the garbage monster trying to attack a squid and eat it. And I think you kind of get that just from the single page. It's, you know, one out of a whole book. But it does tell a story. And it tells a really graphic story that I think has a fair bit of emotion to it. I like this example also. This is The Poison Diaries. And it's a fictitious tale of these poisonous plants in a garden who are out to murder people. And it's a funny, it's sort of a kid's story. But in the illustrations, they've made sort of the poisonous plants come to life, you know, and they're sort of anthropomorphizing toxic plants. And it's meant as a kid's book, but it's very gripping. And the artist who actually did this, I think they were a Disney illustrator working with a botanist in England. So this I included it's not environmental, but it's one of my favorite examples of visual storytelling. It's an immigrant story. It tells of a family moving to a new country and not being able to speak the language or know what anything is. And I have it up here if you want to thumb through it. I think it's just a stunning example of transition. And so if you want to get examples of how you can tell a whole story with just images and not words, this is a really good place to start. Cartoons. Cartoons have a place in my heart. I always read the comics instead of actually reading the words in the newspaper as a kid. I'm not a particularly experienced comic artist, but I've been learning, and there's a lot to showing motion and storytelling in single small panels. I'll show a couple examples. And some of them are funny and some of them aren't. But I just want to mention cartoons. They're not quite illustration. But it's a curated form of storytelling. Everyone read these? This one I love. This was a meme that got passed around Facebook. Kira, who did this, she was at the Oregon Institute of Marine Biology. She was a graduate student, and she's not an illustrator. She just put this together. But I just thought it was hilarious. And it's a great way, and this came out the same time that all the Occupy Wall Street movement was happening. And so it was very timely. And I think this is a good example of how illustration can do something and how images can do something that sometimes a photograph just quite can't get there. So it is a tool for humor sometimes. We're going to talk a little bit about diagrams. They're used a lot in magazines and books, and they're used to explain larger concepts that you can't photograph. This one by Nicole Fuller was published very recently in Science News, and a lot of us have talked about fracking and how it's hard to conceptualize something that you can't easily see, and I think this shows a really nice version of a cutaway. So I wanted to mention that. And then this one is a National Geographic. This one's sort of a nice old one. And it shows sort of a cutaway of inside the beluga's head. And this was a story talking about how the sounds are produced in the songs. And So you can take a photograph of the external, or, you know, you can take a photograph of, you know, some squishy stuff that looks like a pile of meat. But to actually show what's going on, sometimes you really, an illustration can show the perspective and where the organs are and a bigger part of the story. And I think that that's really fun. This is another kind of concept illustration. This is for a story about transgenic tobacco. And so we're talking about how splicing in a couple of different genes can create drought tolerance. Another concept illustration. This one's for smart grid energy. And then the last of my images, and we're talking about some generalizations. So one of the other things that photography does really well is it captures a very specific moment in time or a person. If you're making a generalization, say talking about environmental disaster in Haiti, you want to talk about a population of Haitians instead of a specific Haitian, sometimes an illustration can better convey that generalization. So these are examples from the entomology department at USDA. And so we're not drawing a single beetle. This is a generalization of a beetle. If you've actually seen the beetle specimens at Smithsonian or USDA, they're all like crinkled legs and they're kind of broken, and it takes some reconstruction to put them together in a way that is useful for identification purposes. So sometimes the generalizations are very useful. Again, the panel next to it is a series of generalizations that's been assembled to tell a story of several different kinds of parasitoid flies. The disadvantages to illustration are that it takes an enormous amount of time and money. And if you're working on short publication deadlines, you probably don't have those resources. I know that's why a lot of illustration has gotten cut over the years. I think the important part there is to consider who's your target audience and what are you trying to convey. Sometimes if you have to convey a lot of information very quickly, and you have the budget, it's worth developing the illustration, because if they're only going to look at whatever you're trying to tell them in a minute or two, an illustration will get your idea across much quicker. It takes more time to produce, but in the end, it probably conveys more of the information that you really want. And I just want to make a quick mention that that's one of the reasons that I've ended up going with a field sketch style for my illustration, because I can produce a page a day. For really big projects like this beautiful National Geographic diagrams, I think the turnaround time is on average 7 months to a year. It's an enormous amount of labor. And I think not everybody quite appreciates how much work and research goes into it. I'd say illustration is 90% a research job and 10% rendering. So if you want to find illustrators, these are some really good resources. The Guild of Natural Science Illustrators, the Association of Medical Illustrators. There's a couple of publications online where you can find them. Serban Sourcebooks publishes illustrators for both specifically medical and science illustration, which is the kind of illustration you've been looking at today, mostly. And they also have an index of general illustrations. So if you're looking at funky concept illustrations, sometimes there's different styles of illustrators. Science Art, this is sort of the home for science illustration. And then there's a couple of schools. Raise your hand if you came out of the science writing program at Santa Cruz. Oh, this one today. Okay. I know I run into a lot of the science writers around town. The science illustration, half of that school has been moved to Monterey. But we have 15 students who graduate a year, and the Johns Hopkins program also has, you know, on average about 15 students graduating a year. And you wanted me to make some other notes, but should we move on to the discussion, or should I?
Yeah, I wanted to move on to that for the discussion. Okay. Although I do want to check with Dennis. So is her gauge of how long, you know, one of the really elaborate
questions?
Aha. So what's your turnaround time now?
Journalists working first for newspapers, mostly small newspapers in the West, and then more for magazines and book projects over the last few years. and trying to figure out how to do a slideshow here again. I was going to show you some photos from, from the project that, I just need 1 second to, everybody gets 2 seconds to figure their stuff out. It's just L. Oh, that's what I want. That's what, okay. I'm going to show you some pictures from the project that my wife, author Karen Coates, and I worked on for nearly 7 years, documenting the effects of unexploded ordnance in Laos. And for those of you who didn't catch the speech the other night, the United States bombed Laos during an offshoot of the Vietnam War, and it turned out to be roughly a bombing raid every bombing raid every 8 minutes for 9 solid years between 1964 and 1973, and the U.S. dumped something like 4 billion pounds of explosives on Laos. Estimates are that up to 30% of the bombs that were dropped did not explode when they were dropped, and a large percentage of those bombs remain in the soil today as unexploded ordnance. And to this point, roughly 20,000 people have been either injured or killed since the end of the war by exploding American bombs. And I now have to find the folder that is supposed to show that I want. Yes, okay. This is ridiculous. Sorry. Okay, just go like this. Yeah. No, that's not right either. Holy freaking cow. Okay, so to sort of start this all over again, Karen and I originally went to Laos in 1998, actually as an anniversary present, and I'd wanted to go to the Plain of Jars in northern Laos for years and years and years, having heard about the archaeology up there, and this is sort of our first experience, is flying into Ponsavan in northern Laos on the Plain of Jars in 1998 and looking out the window and saying, wow, those kind of look like bomb craters out there. At the point, we were pretty ignorant of what had gone on there. And when we were on the ground at that point, you know, we toured jars, we saw some stuff that was pretty interesting, and then didn't think too much about it. And a few years later, in 2005, we were asked to go back by archaeology. 2005? Karen's here. She should stand up and say hi. There. Or she should sit down and say hi. And 2005, we went back for a story for Archaeology magazine on what was to be called sort of the most dangerous archaeology site in the world, which is more than a bit of hyperbole. But the Plain of Jars site, it's these massive thousands of stone jars across northern Laos. Nobody's entirely sure who put them there. They were put there a couple thousand years ago, roughly speaking, probably used as funeral urns. There was a UNESCO program going on at the time to try to turn this whole thing into a World Heritage Site. When we went back to do this story, we realized that the bombing story was far bigger than we had known before, and we began working on that sort of from that point. To give you an idea, then, about the extent of that bombing, as I was talking about before, this is a map of data points actually put together by the National Regulation Agency in Laos, the NRA, a totally different NRA from the one we're familiar with, that got bombing data from the U.S. government. And each one of these red dots represents a bombing raid that took place over Laos during those 9 years of bombing. The this area up here is the Plain of Jars. This is the first area where we started. And during the length of the story that we worked on, we went essentially all the way from all the way up north all the way down south and back and forth, documenting the effects of this bombing and meeting people who'd been partially blown up, who'd had families members killed, who were still finding bombs in their fields, and people who were doing clearance work. So to jump back and forth a bit, while we were up there for the archaeology story, the hotel that we stayed at had this lovely mural in the background of what it was like to be on the Plain of Jars in 1968 with the planes bombing overhead, the North Vietnamese fighting, and this remarkable collection of UXO, and you can see, you know, mortar shells and cluster bombs and cluster bomb firing bits in the front end from a drop tank and U.S. and Soviet Army helmets, And even up until now, this is still a common and fun way to decorate hotels in the northern part, actually all parts of Laos. And this was, again, from the story. This was a guy from the Mines Advocacy Group, Meg, who'd been doing clearance work around the Plain of Jars. These are a couple of those 2,000-year-old stone jars. This is for the Archaeology magazine story. From a Hmong school up in some hills miles outside of town in northern Laos. And I'll go through these kind of quickly. Some of these we sort of stumbled across during this first trip in 2005. Other things we started going out and again going back and out to find people who had stories to tell us about the UXO. These are 40-year-old bomb craters, picture taken just a couple years ago. Kind of hard to make out, but they sort of march up this valley heading down into the background. A guy way in the center of the country sleeping underneath a Soviet surfaced air missile that was used, that would have been used to shoot down B-52s. The Vietnamese would have drug it halfway down the Ho Chi Minh Trail and didn't want to drag it back, so they left it in place as a monument. This is another guy named Tao Li down in the very far south of the country, who continued to find these cluster munitions throughout his farm. That's what this is here underneath this tree. Another common thing is for people to go out and collect the scrap metal. I mean, we as Americans dumped tons upon tons of high-quality steel on Laos, and they still go out today to collect that metal scrap. Kids often go out after school or skip school to go out and collect it. Vietnamese traders for a long time, they've since been theoretically outlawed, but Vietnamese traders would buy this scrap, gather it up, send it on trucks back across the border to Vietnam to be resmelted. We have actually, most of this is actually bomb shrapnel that blew up, but there's also a cluster bomb there and an artillery shell. This is again way down in the far south of the country, and these are kids who are actually illiterate and can't count, and one kid among them who can. These kids will go out, collect, get the money from the Vietnamese traders, and then the one kid who could count would then count the money back for the kids so they know how much they got. And then they'd go outside, and another Vietnamese trader's wife would set up this little gambling thing, and they'd all gamble their money away at night and then buy cigarettes and stuff like that, too. There are some, I guess, good spots to the story. This is Jim Harris. He's a retired grade school principal from Wausau, Wisconsin, and he has devoted essentially his retirement to doing clearance work in Laos. He had a bunch of Hmong kids who showed up in his school district starting in the late 70s, early 80s, and wondered who these people were and where they came from. And since retirement, he goes back to Laos once or twice a year with money he's raised in Wisconsin to do clearance work. And here he's with a mutual friend named Yai as a translator, sitting in a village meeting in the middle of nowhere in the middle of night to figure out, do they have a bomb problem? Can he help them out? Here he is with another bunch of village elders a couple of years later, drinking lau lau, which is rice whiskey, which is fairly common and pretty fun. This is part of his group doing clearance work way in the far north of the country in a village that had never had any clearance work done there before. And this is literally right outside a school. Sort of 20 meters behind the school on the other side, they actually found cluster munitions on the hillside right there. Got into a bit of a problem over whether or not they could remove them because it was a sacred area, and they thought the spirits must have wanted to have the cluster bombs there. Otherwise, they wouldn't be there, so you probably shouldn't detonate them, which is another long story. But anyway, lots of clearance work has not been done throughout Laos. And then he'll stay up late at night in his laptop, typing up emails to be sent later with his laptop hooked up to a car battery. And that's how he gets his money and gets it done. Again, one of his clearance crews working in the far north of Laos, they found cluster munitions in this little tiny valley here, which was actually going to be a doctor's garden. They knew that there was going to be cluster munitions here because just up the hillside over here, a couple of years previously, a young Vietnamese girl had been blown up while looking for bamboo shoots, a common food staple. Another trio of cluster bombs they found and were blowing up in another farmer's field. And if you start to get kind of a feel for this, Laos is a very rural agrarian country. Most people live out in the countryside. Most people are farmers or helping farmers. So this story really is an environmental story in the end, because these bombs are in the environment and keep people from doing things in the environment and affect the way people deal with things in the environment. This is a guy who's by hand diffused, by his own count, some 10,000 large bombs, and he has this as a monument these diffused bombs in his front yard. Recycling scrap once again. They recycle aluminum bits, turn them into spoons, turn them into buckets, things like that. It's just a fired hearth. These are one-time drop tanks from American military planes, been turned into a boat. This is actually a fairly common scene. And this is actually one of the smelters in the center of the country. So tons and tons of American steel scrap metal will be trucked to these smelters and then turned into rebar. And they're the most hellish sorts of things that I've ever seen. Occasionally, bits of bombs will still have explosive things on them. They'll throw them into these huge fiery pits in the background, and they flare up. It's very Dante-esque on the whole. And billows of green and black smoke pouring out of the thing. And it all goes now to make rebar, for the most part. So, and then there's, of course, because of all this, there are lots of stories being injured. This young Hmong boy, again up north, off the Plain of Jars, was injured. If I recall correctly, his sister found a cluster bomb and tossed it, and it blew up. And actually, she didn't get hurt, but it injured her brother. These are scars from shrapnel from a U.S. cluster bomb. This young kid was farming, again, up north, and he doesn't actually know what happened, but what they could tell after the fact. He woke up in the hospital, essentially. The family heard an explosion, ran out, saw there was a crater in the ground. He likely was trying to put a stake into the ground to tie his water buffalo, if I recall correctly, and it blew up and injured him. He took off part of his jaw, partially blinded him in one eye, and left him with shrapnel in his abdomen. This guy is a fellow named Ta. He says he found a cluster bomb and accidentally blew up. He lost both of his arms and was blinded by this. He has five kids, I think, who now help him live. I mean, they help him do every human function you think of, from eating to everything else. And that's how he's able to get on in life, out in the sticks. This is not an uncommon sight. This guy stepped on a landmine, actually, which is fairly uncommon. Most of the stuff that was dropped on Laos, not landmines, but other styles of bombs. But he lost his foot to an American mine, and the bucket that's next to him was actually made from a flare canister that would have been dropped from a plane. And this happens all too often as well. This fellow's son died while out collecting scrap. He found a bomb of some sort that blew up and killed him and two other people, I think, at the same time, and injured another three people. And they're an animist group from lives in the highlands in the center of the country. And this is the spirit house that they built for the son who died. And the father still comes out here and talks to him and brings him food. This was actually the first picture I took, knowing that I was going to begin working on this story. This is back during that story that we did for Archaeology magazine. We were coming back from a jar site, and I saw this bomb by the side of the road and had the driver in the car that we were in stop. I hopped out, and in my bad Lao, I asked this guy, could I take your picture next to the bomb? He said, oh, yeah, sure. Su Lin's his name. He leaned over in perfectly like this. There was no setup really beyond that. Can I take your picture? He said yes. He leaned up against the bomb. Snip, snip, two frames, and as I'm walking back to the car, I realized this is a much, much bigger story than we'd realized to this point. And pretty much all of the pictures that you've seen flow from this one here in a short little walk back to the car after seeing all of these things. It's not seen a lot in Laos. I don't know how many of you may have actually been to Laos. It seems everybody's going to Laos these days as a tourist, and if you've been there, it's probably unlikely you've seen it in this depth, but this is not an exaggeration of what's going on. This is really what happens just off the tourist trail if you're in Laos. This is a monument to several hundred people who died in a cave, again in the north of Laos, that was bombed. It was a cave that the locals used as a bomb shelter and was bombed, I think, pretty close to Thanksgiving Day on 1968. And essentially everybody inside the cave was killed. Everybody in the cave was killed when the roof of the cave collapsed. And the people who survived made this little monument. There's still human bones and bits of clothing still on the rubble on the floor. And then we're back to the beginning of it. So, long story short, as we're talking about the future of visual journalism, this is the sort of story that I've tried to work on generally for the last 20 years, is these longer involved pieces, as Michael brought up, from this sort of Eugene Smith tradition of putting together a very long, involved story and showing it visually. And in the last several years, the last 5 years in particular, the possibilities to do this sort of journalism, they're just not really there anymore. National Geographic is one shining example to the opposite, but they're also not funded like they used to be from everything I hear, and it's just very, very difficult to find the funding to do this sort of work, very, very difficult to find places to put this sort of work that can actually pay you for the work that you do that goes into it. I mean, again, this is years worth and 10, 12 trips back to Laos working on this. That's expensive. That racks up. So recently I began a totally different story, which is also not in order now. So I'll try to put this in some sort of order. Here we go. And Karen and I, a few years back, got a house in just outside Albuquerque, just a little ways from the Rio Grande River, and noticed it's a beautiful river. It's a great place with the bosque on each side to go ride your mountain bike, to go running, just to go hiking in the river. And noticed that every year in about August, the river would go away. There'd be no water left in it, and it would stink of all the different chemicals that had been dumped into it. And I thought, you know, this is not a good thing, but didn't spend a lot of time thinking about it. Until the last couple of years, and decided, well, I should probably do some sort of project on this when I'm not working in Asia. And I've sort of slowly begun taking pictures, looking at the river, and trying to figure out a way to do a story rather than a very direct story like you just saw of this happened here, and this person saw this, and this person did that, and this picture leads to the next one. Sort of a more, I guess, poetic progression of how people and culture live alongside a river that has been there for centuries, in a place where people have lived along the river for centuries, and how that's changing as the river dries up and goes away and is overused. So these are actually more notes than a full picture essay. These are just pictures I've taken over the last few years as I try to think about how to work and think about this story. This is from Big Bend National Park here in Texas that shot last summer, where, you know, you get these huge skies and even a big river running small, still see in the distance. This is a 500-year-old arroyo that runs through the village that Karen and I live in the middle of New Mexico. And connected, all the water in the arroyos comes from the Rio Grande River. This is also near our village. There's some teenagers out drinking beer and fishing at the effluent discharge pipe from the sewage treatment plant at the village that we live in New Mexico. And since it's a little bit warmer and actually cleaner than the river itself, the fish hang out next to the effluent pipe. And kids hang out there and drink beer. Sorry. Oh, sorry. So I'll just go through this quickly as a series of cultural pictures that happen along the side of the river. Between our house and the mouth of the Rio Grande at Brazos Island down in Texas. And I'm looking at all these pictures as I'm taking them and editing through them, and I'm thinking, I can try to pitch this as a book, I can try to pitch this as a magazine article, but really, is this going to be the best way to tell this story? And I'm thinking, perhaps not. So I'm actually a scripts fellow at CU Boulder this year, and my project is to begin looking at ways to tell this particular story of life along the Rio Grande as actually some sort of interactive ebook, iPhone type application, and try to figure out how to match pictures with stories from individual people, with maps, with environmental news that comes out. And this one, this is again down at Big Bend, and this is a tourist from upstate New York actually waving at people across what's left of the Rio Grande right there, which is this tiny little ditch that you see. This is Mexico back over here. And he's just waving at them because they were yelling back and forth and talking. It was like 115 degrees. It was crazy hot. So I'm trying to think of ways to, instead of telling stories in the very literal, straightforward way that I have done in the past, in sort of a more encompassing manner, visually as well as electronically. And so there, I think you got some idea of the picture stuff. This is actually Albuquerque in a huge drainage ditch there. And another teenager sucking beer out of a broken can. It's actually kind of my favorite picture yet. I'm going really long. Yeah, well, wouldn't be me otherwise, would it? This is also... So, the thing that I saw that really sort of inspired me to start thinking differently about this whole idea was that map that you saw of bombing points in Laos. Quickly. Come on. You can do it. No, it's not going to work for me. It's not connected. All right. Well, it's to somehow connect the mapping ideas that are out there with things that show up on your phone with pictures and the like. For example, I have a list of EPA watch sites that are all over the United States. It's an app you can get for your phone, which could work as an overlay for a map that works with pictures, that could work as an overlay on maps that works with stories, say looking at the Rio Grande, where you could be on the Rio and you could find stories from around the area where you are. And you could look at it, I would think, the river in different ways. That's essentially what I'm getting at. And that's essentially the whole point of me talking a long time here, is I'm thinking and moving from telling stories in a particularly direct photographic way and trying to figure out how to tell them in a more open, handheld manner, I guess. And I would show more, but it's not really what I'm doing. So, anyway. Yeah, okay, sorry. Yeah.
So, Michael came to me this morning about 8:30 when I was having breakfast, and he said, "Will you join this panel?" I had nothing to say, nothing organized, and it was like, oh, okay, well, so what can I say or do today that's actually going to be helpful to you guys? And so what I thought about was this. So about 8 years ago, I got a phone call from Jim Detchen, and I was working at the Geographic doing what I do in my office, and he said, "Why don't you come out to Michigan State and talk to my students about what you do?" And that, in fact, was the first time I'd ever been asked to go out and stand up and try to make coherent sense of the work I do. And it was a slideshow. And so what I've been doing for the last 8 years is giving slideshows, maybe over 200 of them, over the course of those years, trying to make sense of global change. And so what I'm going to do here for you today, imagine it's kind of a meta deal. I'm going to show you some stuff, but I'm going to be talking to you about how I do it. And the reason for it is not so much, I'm not here to talk about National Geographic photography or all the money and the time, but what I'm trying to do is try to think about for all of us that all of us are living in a world of change and that we're no longer just writers or photographers, but often what we're asked to do is to go out and talk to the public about what we do. And there's a whole culture of death by PowerPoint out there. People open up PowerPoint, they put this crap in there, and then they stand up, and then they spend all their time apologizing for the terrible presentation. And so what I want to do is really talk to you a little bit about how can you do something with often a lot of still images that are public domain or data that's public domain and make things move and make them interesting in simple ways. And so I just threw a bunch of examples together from a bunch of different things I do on water and energy, climate, the Anthropocene, and I'll just walk through them for you so that we can talk about them a little bit. But I hope when you get done, you walk away going, oh, I could do that too. And I think it's more than just the writing. It's like how to become a public journalist too. So these are really covers of magazines. These are all things that I've been involved in since 2004. Magazine cover stories on melting ice and climate, energy, water, oil, soil. A growing few biofuels in 2000. Soil, that took 9 years to do. Energy efficiency. I mean, water, a special issue. And last year, a series on population. So let's talk about population, okay? So population's changing, right? We know that, 7.1 billion. But did you know, Carl Hobb pointed this out from Population Reference Bureau, that in 1900 there were 1.6 billion of us, and in 2000 there were 6.1 billion of us. See, all I'm doing is taking numbers, making something that's interesting, and you guys are going to remember that, right? And so then you take, and then you go, oh, okay, so population moves, right? All I'm doing is taking public data, I put them into a $20 program, Apple Keynote, and I make it move, right? And I can say, I was born in 1951, there were 2.5 billion of us, we're now at 7 billion. Who knows where we're going? But it moves, and you're engaged, you see? And that's what I'm trying, or changing atmosphere. Well, you could take this curve and put it right next to the population curve without the slides in between, and you go, oh, there's a correlation, isn't there? More people, more CO2. Imagine that, right? We can get into causation later, but all I'm doing is taking Charles David Keeling's data and making it move so that you go, oh, look, it's more than just some graph that you yank off a government website. And then you can say, but the chemistry, the atmosphere is changing, so that then you can use an example. And unfortunately, these are just fragments, but what I'm trying to do is just to give you a sense that we're living in a world of more people, more money, more things. And what is that? What's the heart of all that? What's the basis of all that? More energy, right? That's what's driving everything. You want to talk about climate change, you've got to talk about energy. You want to talk about stopping it, you have to change the way you use energy on the planet. Right now it's more natural gas, it's more oil, like this. This is the boreal forest in Alberta. You know what they do to it? They take it away. And there's where your oil comes from, friends. That's showing change, okay? Okay, changing impact. This graphic came from a story that we did last year on the Anthropocene era. Elizabeth Cole wrote the essay, and the graphic came from a formula that Barry Commoner, Paul Ehrlich, and John Holdren came up with in the early 70s, and it was about impact. IPAT was the formula. It was called impact equals population times affluence times technology. So all this is, this is a poor adaptation from the print version. I would redo this if I was going to really go big on screen, but the point was I was just trying to do something quickly. So the little rectangles that you see down there, that's a volumetric analysis of our presence on the planet as measured by XYZ, billions of people, number of patents, amount of money floating around. Now, people can say, oh, but technology is not all bad. I'm not saying it is. It's just an analysis of our cumulative impact. So there we are at 1950. The little thing inside is, what is it, 1900 or something. Okay, here's where we are in 2011. That's why the globe is changing. That's the natural resource demand that we're putting on the planet right now. It's called the Great Acceleration from 1950 to 2011, 61 years. That's what we've done. Everybody wants more. More of us wanting more. So, and there you go. Here's a picture that Sarah Lean of our staff did. Everything in this house that came out here is made of oil. Okay? There it is. We eat oil. We live oil. We are oil. Changing footprint. Let's talk about that. Ecological Footprint Network is, all I'm doing is taking four pictures off the NASA website, and they say, okay, we live on one Earth. We currently live like there's 1.5 Earths of ecological resources to sustain us. And if everybody lived like Americans, we need four. So what I'm trying to do is I'm just trying to get you to go, oh, right, I get that now. And you walk away and you go, imagine, we have quite a footprint, don't we? So how much water? I did this thing. I built this. This took a couple hours, but it's the idea of how much water is in the world. This is all done in Keynote. I'm just taking this guy, Shiklamanov from UNESCO, his numbers. And 97.5% of it's sea, 2.5% is freshwater. I'm trying to get at the point of how little there is. So then I come to the second part. There's the first graph up in the corner, and I'm trying to build out the fresh. Two-thirds of it's locked up in glaciers and snow. A third of it's in groundwater, like in the Ogallala. See that 0.001%? Well, how much of the total water in the world is that? That's rivers, lakes, and swamps. 0.007% of 1% of all the water in the world is the water that we live on, other than the mineable water that we pull out of the aquifers. So I'm just trying to get these kinds of things to be simple here, like world water uses. Well, where's the water go? Okay, World Bank numbers. 70% goes to agriculture. Okay, oops, sorry, it went too fast. I'm not going to go back. Okay, you want to see an example, though? Here, all this is 10 pictures from the NASA Earth Observatory website, all public domain stuff. And so you know what's happened to the Aral Sea. The Amudarya River has been diverted for surplus cotton growing. Okay, you want to know what it looks like? Here we go. All I'm doing is running 9 pictures in animation over 9 years. Well, there's the former Aral Sea, right? It makes an impact on people when they see, boom, look, how about that? It's all gone. Just so we could grow surplus cotton. 60 years of changing temperatures, more charts from NASA. All I'm doing is taking charts that are 10 years apart and watch the world warm up. That's the anomaly from the norm every 10 years. And so what do you see? You see that the top of the planet, the northern hemisphere, that's more than 2 degrees centigrade from the norm. So that's what we're seeing, and it's as a result of all that carbon we're pumping in the atmosphere. Let's talk about changing seasons. It's the same thing. So I've been showing this thing for years. This started in the planning zones map in 1990 from the USDA. You know, planning zones, we're like talking about the last freeze date in the spring, the first freeze date in the fall. If you're a farmer or a gardener, you're acutely attuned to this stuff. Okay, let's drop the dot right here, and I think that's where we are in Lubbock today. And okay, now let's dial it forward. This is an old map, but you get the idea. So we dial it forward 16 years. All the growing zones are moving north. What happened? Look at the cold. Look at the winter. It's going away. So you come back and you look at the Dakotas and Minnesota. Watch what happens. It's going away. That's what climate change is. It's not weather. It's climate is shifting. The seasons are changing. And I'm just trying to show the evidence of these kinds of changes. Okay, this one. This is new. I built this one last weekend. And so this is 1979. This is the first year the satellite record showed the Arctic ice cap in September, the first picture that was taken. And until last week, I showed 2011, and 40% of it was gone. But here's last month. Half of it's gone now. 20% more melted this year than any year before. So we're in a world of change, and so it's a way for you to think about, if you're trying to talk to people about these issues, it's easier for you to put this stuff together. If you're doing a website or a blog, I mean, you could take the two slides things, turn it into a little slideshow. Anything, any of these things, you could yank out and modularize it and make them part of the stuff that you're trying to do to help use more than just words to tell these kinds of stories. Okay, last month it was our cover story. I'm almost near the end, but it's like this was our cover story. We were trying to explain where's the linkage, the correlation between warming temperatures, climate change, and changes in the weather. And we did two stories. One was about weather, and we talked about the whole sort of the loaded dice effect of what happens when you add more temperature. But what the heart of it was that we quantified it with data. And so we did a sidebar here that was basically all about where we are this weekend. You'll see the film tonight. I've seen part of it already. It's a great film. Okay, so air temperature, moisture, extreme rainfall, and heat waves. That was the heart of the story. We had all the pictures and we had the text, but this was the data set that we built that we were trying to show. Here's the evidence. And all I'm doing here is taking the stuff from the print version. So things aren't moving, but I had to move something, so I added in the type. So what do you see? Over the last 40 years, we've seen a 9/10 of a degree of Fahrenheit increase in temperatures globally. Moisture, the amount of moisture that the air can hold has increased by 4%. You get warmer temperatures, the atmosphere holds more moisture. That's why you get more things like extreme rainfall events. And there's been in the U.S. a 7% increase in the incidence of extreme rainfall, that being events that are more extreme than the top 10% of the most extreme previous events, so that they're outside that boundary. And then you get, it's sort of more wet, more dry. And then you come here, heat waves, just like this summer, what we've seen. This is actual observed data. So you have from 1970 to 2010, you've actually seen a 31% increase in heat waves. So you take more temperature, more moisture, more extreme rainfall, and more heat waves. No wonder you're seeing more extreme weather events. And all we were trying to do is use data to help explain it, so people weren't going, oh, you liberals, you're just causing problems here. But we were just trying to use data to help tell the story and have some sense of evidence. So at the end, change ahead. I think it's like, okay, here's where we are, but where we're going. This study that David Battisti and Ross Naylor did in Science for me 3 years ago still sends chills down my spine. And what they did was that they took all the models from the 2007 IPCC AR4, all the models looking forward to mid-century and beyond, given business as usual emissions of carbon. And they used the 2003 summer in Europe as a baseline, that being the warmest on record. And so what you have here is what you're looking at with this map is you're seeing, oh, well, what percentage of your summers in the future by mid-century are going to be warmer than that summer? And what you see, for example, more than half of those right where we are going to be hotter than that summer of 2003. Keep going on your business as usual emissions, and this is what the world's going to look like at the end of the century in terms of summers. You want to talk about drought and heat and the ability of crops to adapt. half the people on the planet live between 30 degrees north and 30 degrees south, mostly in that area where you see red. They live on subsistence, rain-fed agriculture, and $2 a day. That's where the future of food is going to be. And so then you talk about, Catherine Hayhoe talked about this morning. She said that study from the National Academy that nobody's read. I read enough of it to do this. And I think this is very telling about where we're going in terms of environmentally and as environmental journalists. What you get for every degree of warming, 1.8 degrees Fahrenheit, you get 5 to 10% total less rain. Okay, Southwest North America. You get 5 to 10% less river stream flow. See, all I'm doing is taking numbers and trying to make them move a little bit, and you get 5 to 15% lower crop yields. That's the cumulative effect of a business-as-usual world that we're living in with carbon emissions. Stabilization targets for atmospheric greenhouse gas concentrations, National Research Council, 2 years ago. And lastly, so here, this was a piece, this was a study that David Lobel and Wolfram Schlenker did last year in Science, and they were looking at global crop harvest trends now, globally. And they didn't include the U.S. because as of when the study was done, the U.S. had not been affected. So 2011 is not even part of this. They were already seeing that global corn yields were down 3.8% and global wheat down was already down 5.5%. So that's data, and all I'm really trying to do is tell the story to you guys in ways that you could go, oh, I could do that too. And it's pretty simple to just use numbers and sort of A, B, C, and sequences. And so that's my little thing that I did this morning, and I hope that that engenders some conversation.
Wow. So I guess if you work at National Geographic from 1980 on, you develop the skill set to be able to knock something like that out over breakfast.
I think you have to be really interested in this stuff. That's one thing I would say, that for me, these issues, energy, climate, sustainability, the Anthropocene, you got to live it, you got to be passionate about it, and you got to basically live it. And for me, it's like, you know, it's like, I don't know what, going to get a fresh drink of water. For me, it's like, it's all about my life.
So we actually do have a little bit of time left. I know we started late and we rushed a few things, but the folks who need to get to the general meeting, nobody's going to be offended, but if anybody's got any questions or any things they'd like to bring up as far as visual communication goes, we've got a little bit of time. So anybody? Christine? You want to say, well, I'll say, you know, at least when I deal with writers who haven't taken a lot of pictures before, I find that people just don't get close enough. That, you know, you get in front of your subject, because, you know, the number of times they come back with, you know, somebody with their action, you know, and they're completely behind them, because, you know, the thing of it is, and anybody here that's worked with radio would understand it, you know, it takes a little bit of chutzpah to go and shove a camera in somebody's face. It takes a little chutzpah to go and shove a microphone in somebody's face. And so, you know, generally I try to push, my students and others to, you know, get close. And, you know, spend a little time learning your equipment and then spend a little time developing a relationship with the person that you're photographing, you know, so you know, it's not like an afterthought, hey, I need to make a picture for my column and, you know, it takes them 10 seconds, but, you know, they don't have, you know, they've got basically a very uncomfortable person standing a long way away from their camera as opposed to chatting with them enough so that they get comfortable with them and spending enough time on the photo so that, you know, they're making something that the subject's going to be comfortable with. Tools for editing the photos or tools for making the photos? There are a number of pretty simple programs for making audio slideshows. Sound Slides is one that's been quite popular, and I've done a lot in Premiere and Final Cut. One thing that I think that people that have done radio have an advantage at is I really prefer. I'm so tired of seeing audio slideshows where you just put music behind it. Even if it's, you know, great music and well recorded, I just can't bear it. I like to hear dialogue from the person that you photographed. And so recognizing when you're recording them for radio that you need to get enough dialogue to go with your photos. And I have a couple of times taken a photo, particularly now that it's digital, and shown them the photo. And I don't know if anybody used to read this, What Were They Thinking, in the New York Times magazine, where somebody would be shown a photograph of them in a situation and they'd have to describe what was going on in their head. And it's kind of like that, you know, here's a situation that you were in. Can you tell me what happened? What was going on here? And then just kind of record an oral history to go with that.
Yeah, just in terms of slideshows, I mean, this thing, Keynote's $20, and it's what all of our Keynote, it's $20 if you have a Mac. You got to have a Mac. Sorry, if you have a PC, you're out. You'll have to go buy a Mac. But it's like the reason I use it, here's the reason I use it. And I even have, I do own the latest versions of PowerPoint. Why don't I use PowerPoint? Because Keynote is the only program that gives you true cross dissolves with photographs. All that stuff you saw there, it would be all pixelated in PowerPoint, and the transition would take away from the power of what you were trying to say. And so, if you can put movies in these things, it's amazingly powerful program. Also, Aperture, which is the image editing program that Apple also sells, is $80. And it's like nobody ever talks about the power that it also is. It has a very powerful slideshow movie presentation module in it. So it allows you to integrate all your libraries, and you can save movies and then build out multimedia slideshows. And it's nobody ever talks about that part of what it does.
Yeah, actually, so Keynote is a much better program for handling photos. I mean, it just handles them much better, and graphics, they just look better. However, for the Aperture end of it, I actually work in a program called Lightroom, which is an Adobe product. And also very similar to Aperture, and you can put together slideshows in it really quickly. It's
cross-platform.
Yeah, and that PC or Mac. And it's seamless with Photoshop because it's an Adobe product. So, it's a great way to manage all of your files. And you can, put video into Lightroom now and as part of your archive. So when I shoot video, you know, my videos and my stills are in the same catalog, and you can scrub through them and play them and do minor editing on them. So those are both terrific programs.
Any thoughts over here?
Well, I use Macs, but
my
smartphone is not.
And there's, even a few editing programs that you can use on smartphones or iPads now, you can do kind of basic video and photo editing, so you don't even have to put it into your laptop.
Sure. Oh, okay.
Yeah, the Droid app I use is called Cam Scanner. It's useful for just image capture and basic correction.
So that's another thing, as far as tools go, that I kind of encourage everybody to do that's working with videos and photos. And first of all, I mean, this panel wasn't just for people that want to create the content. It's also for people that want to work with people that create the content. And Dennis and I were talking a lot, and actually all of us at different times about, one of the challenges with working with people that create this content is you're often not told about a story or brought on board early enough. And very often you're a writer and you're doing your reporting, and it's natural, particularly coming from a newsroom background like I did, that you kind of want to keep your story close to the vest, and you don't want people, you know, in the newsroom knowing too much about it and poaching you on it. And, I had it happen where I got brought in to do a story that they'd been working on for a year and a half on wildlife re-encroaching into Connecticut, and they had a wonderful National Geographic at the newsroom desk with these camera trap photos that they'd worked on for years of wildlife. And they said, well, we need you to get some pictures like this. The pup date's in 3 weeks. And it's like, you know, I might be able to get you a deer, but, you know, you're not going to get a mountain lion, and you're not going to get a bear. You know, this takes a lot of time. And, you know, why are you bringing me in now? So late. So that's one thing, recognize when it's not something you're going to be able to do or that you're going to want to do, and partner up with the right people early on. Know what you're looking for, or know what the potentials are, which is kind of one of the things we want to convey in here, so that you can find your partners on this and your allies and have them working on it with you early on. That makes a huge, huge difference.
Yeah, when we start our stories, we sit and talk, and we talk about the direction that the text is going to take. We talk about the nature of the photo coverage, both in style and extent. What kind is it going to be? Is it going to be studio? Is it going to be reportage, street photography? What is the look of it going to be? Are we trying to do street photography? Are we trying to do something that has more of a unified aesthetic to it, a style to it? We talk about the nature of the informational graphics and the artwork and the maps, and we also talk about the implementation that's going to appear on the iPad all before we start the project.
Yeah, so one other thing I was going to say about, you know, tools is everybody here should learn how to manage metadata really well now. And there's just all kinds of it that you can get, and these programs like Aperture and Lightroom all will keep track of it for you. And, you know, if you go to some place like Al Gore's last book, which was just an iPad app, it's what's called an enhanced ebook, which I'm working on and I know other people are starting to look into. And, you know, all of the photos are geotagged, so there's just a little button on these beautiful displayed photos. You want to know where it was taken, you just tap the corner and it zooms into a globe and it shows you precisely where the photo was taken. That's a lot of work to do after the fact. But not that hard if you're collecting the GPS data when you're recording the video or making those photos, and it's already in there. And there's lots of other types of metadata that, you know, if you know you're going to need it later on, if you have that program to be gathered in your camera and sucked into your program with the photos and the video, you've got a huge advantage of tying your photos and video and audio content with the kind of things that Dennis was showing, you know, where you can create informational graphics, you can, you know, put them into keynotes with geographic information, or you can, you know, do the kind of things that Jim Balog is doing, you know, where he's documenting the retreat of glaciers over a period of years with remote cameras. And there's all kinds of metadata that you can be gathering with that so that you can graphically show what's going on with the glaciers and things like that. So, you know, learn what metadata you need and be gathering that as you're doing it. It's so much easier to be gathering that up front, you know, reporting well with your camera and your video camera. I think they're really fun. I think they're mostly branding tools right now. I've used a couple of photos like that in projects at different times, because I just didn't have the camera that I wanted handy. And there's an old saying in photojournalism, the best camera is the one that you have with you. I think that we're going to see increasing democratization of these tools. But it gets back to what Em was saying. It's kind of like, you know, everybody here can write, but that doesn't mean everybody here can write a good story. And so everybody can take a picture, but it doesn't necessarily mean that they can take a picture with the appropriate content in it, or, you know, make a video with the appropriate content in it. And, you know, we're going to see more and more saturation of imagery. And, I mean, you can see incredibly polished video coming out constantly. In fact, it was just announced that GoPro, you know, which makes these little cameras that skiers and skateboarders mount on their helmets, and we do all this really cool video, is coming out with a 5K camera, which is just a massive, high-def, incredibly powerful little teeny camera like that. So you're going to see an immense amount of material out of that. And I think you're going to get really tired of it really quickly, because most of the people that are making, you know, hours and hours and hours of video with this are not telling you a story. And so, you know, it's like right now it's really popular with DSLR video, like I'm doing, to have sliders, little mini sliders and cranes. You can see these shots all the time where, you know, the camera moves nice and smoothly past this and that. And it, you know, it's an effective storytelling tool, but it gets really, really hackneyed. And, you know, it's like time lapse is really big right now. And like every time you see an outdoor video, there has to be a time lapse of them setting up their tent or getting their kayak put together. And the first time you see it, it's like, wow, that's cool. And like the 20th time you see it, it's like, oh my God, can we fast forward through this? I get it. So it really all comes back down to storytelling skills and really good reporting. And so I think all those things will be very useful. But I think the people that actually have developed storytelling skills and have something to say with those images are going to make good images. And the rest of that stuff is going to kind of fall away. I think that most of like the filters in Hipstamatic, if it was something that I'd like done in Photoshop 10 years ago when I had a staff job at a newspaper to make a photo look cool, unless it was a photo illustration, you know, where it was labeled that this is a manipulated photo on, say, the food page, I'd have been fired. You know, I think that kind of gets back to intent. I mean, you know, if you want to create a special project, like say fashion or something with a look to it, you can certainly do that. But, you know, if you're manipulating people with the filters and the things you can do with those things, if you're misleading people, then I think that becomes a problem.
I want to talk about one thing. Damon Winter is a photographer for the New York Times, and last year he won an award in Pictures of the Year with a series of pictures he did about soldiers in Afghanistan. And I think that is a perfect example for us to talk about how the presence of photographers changes the situation that they are in. And we can talk all day long about how the filters in Hipstamatic may create a surreal look, but if I'm out photographing and I haul out a Canon 5D, all of a sudden the nature of the situation that I am in totally changes. And if Damon Winter was on the front lines with those soldiers, and those soldiers had pulled out their phones and they were taking pictures of each other with their phones, and he happened to haul out his phone and he was taking pictures of them with his phone just like they were, he was just one of the guys. And he was able to get pictures that he would never have been able to get had he hauled out the big guns. And I think that there's a place for these cameras, as long as your intent is you're there to represent and not misrepresent. And there are ways around these filters. Since he did that project, you can get other lesser filters and the pictures look much more close to real. So I wouldn't write them off. I think it's a really interesting trend now, because what you're doing is you're putting cameras in the hands of millions of people. And it's all of a sudden we have citizen journalists, citizen scientists. There's very interesting data that can come out of this, not to mention the best camera is the one you have. And in a lot of situations, you'd ask the first question about what kind of rig. I would easily, happily take pictures on an iPhone, because for most uses, they're pretty good. 8 megapixels, that's pretty good. That's better than the pro cameras. We were big pro cameras we were using them with 7 years ago. So,
yeah, I just think that the tools are, you know, getting into more and more people's hands, and you're going to see people, you know, with kind of coming from left field with no training. That's right. Yeah, I remember that. Yeah. You know, and another thing that I was going to say is that there's a lot of fabulous work out there in the grand tradition of photojournalism still being done. Just because we have all of these new tools doesn't mean that everything's being done in video or with iPhones. And so last night I was with, a new friend, Krista Schuyler, who has a really cool book on the wall between Mexico and the U.S. being built and its impact on species and biodiversity. And I think it's out there, but it's really worth thumbing through. And this is kind of a classic photojournalism project. You know, this is, you know, somebody who worked on something for a really long time like Jerry did, and probably worked a lot with film. And, you know, this is, you know, we still have our grand traditions of photojournalism continuing. We have a lot more options and a lot of other cool things that we can do. Great. Yeah, she has paints up here. anything else? Anybody? Oh, great. Thank you so much.